Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, sponsored by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new Media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Peter Carlson could have taken all the research he did on Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's two-week barnstorming tour of the United States in 1959 and converted it into a Cold War-era fable such as Dr. Strangelove or The Mouse That Roared. He could have done that, but truth is stranger than fiction, and the truths found within Cablo's Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's most unlikely tourist, are way funnier than even a guy like Dave Barry could have invented. I first discovered this book when the story of Chairman K's visit to Hollywood was excerpted in Smithsonian Magazine this summer. I read that, laughed, and thought, I must read more. And now that I've read more, I want to talk about it. So welcome to Mr. Media's Book Club, where I'm hoping former Washington Post reporter Peter Carlson will fill us in on the story behind the story of this ticklish new political history. Peter, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you, Mr. Media.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And listen, I'm assuming that I'm not the only guy who was born in 1960 or later who somehow missed out on hearing about Chairman Khrushchev's tour of the U.S.
No, you're not the only one. And I think what most Americans know about Khrushchev is only a few things. One, that he banged his shoe on a desk at the U.N. Another, that he wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland, and maybe that he started the Cuban Missile Crisis. And other than that, most people don't know much, unless they run out and read Cablo's Top.
Which, of course, they should do. how did you – and by the way, now I'm how old am I? 48, 49? I think I'm 48 still. How old are you, Peter?
I am 56.
Okay, so – you were around at the time. Do you have any direct memories of this happening or of Khrushchev's?
No, I don't have memories of Khrushchev's tour when I was seven then. I do have very vivid memories of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was in 1962, mm-hmm. 3 years later, when, of course, Khrushchev wasn't here, but it looked like the war might end in a nuclear holocaust, and that was a very vivid memory because I was in Catholic school at the time, and to make a long story short, the principal of the school, who was a nun, told us all to get down on our knees and start praying because this could be the end of the world. And we prayed. We prayed like we'd never did before. And apparently that did the trick because the world did not end.
Well, thank you. I think we all owe you a great debt of gratitude.
Yes, you do, in fact.
Although I have to say, I still remember in, 67, 68, doing the old duck and cover drills at Maple Mead Elementary School, an old brick two-story schoolhouse in my hometown in New Jersey, and still doing those drills. So the threat may have vanished, but the fear was still there.
Well, they were still doing them in 67, huh? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's funny to think back on it and realize how useless all that was.
Yeah, even at the time, I mean, when I was a kid, they used to bring us inside, into the inside hallway, I guess to get us away from the windows, which, you know, blowing glass probably wouldn't have been good for us. But I remember sitting there, you know, in the duck and cover position and thinking, why aren't we at least under a desk or something? So in case something falls from the ceiling, we'll be protected. But nobody, not even the kids, you know, the dumb kids who used to eat that white glue, not even they thought that this would protect us from a nuclear bomb.
you know, one of the, I want to ask you this now. I think I could have waited, but I want to ask you. One of the things I get from the book is that the people who were running this country at the time, after spending up close and personal time with Khrushchev and Gromyko and Smiling Mike, I get the sense that they knew at the time that a lot of what was going on with Khrushchev was positioning himself, and that they actually had a pretty good idea that maybe he couldn't do quite all the things that he claimed he could do, that the world might not, that he might be no more inclined to end the world than they were, but it was probably good politics to keep up the fear-mongering.
Yeah, well, he could, he could have blown us up, and so that wasn't, that, there was a threat.
There was a threat.
And
no,
they
absolutely
met this guy, and he was baffling to them, because on the one hand, he could be really funny and charming and kind of warm, and on the other hand, he kept throwing these temper tantrums, and they could never figure out whether he was play-acting or whether they were real. So they were a little worried, but of course the fear-mongering always helped to crank up the military-industrial complex. I mean, they bought more and more weapons for our side. In fact, when Khrushchev was meeting Eisenhower at Camp David, and they're walking around the grounds, and Khrushchev said, you know, what happens to me is probably what happens to you. My generals come in and they say, hey, the Americans have, you know, X, Y, and Z, and we need to match that. And I say to them, well, we don't have any money. And they say, well, if there's a war, the Americans will win because we don't have X, Y, and Z. So I say, well, okay, we'll fund X, Y, and Z. And so Eisenhower said, well, you know, that's exactly what happens to me. My generals come to me and they say, the Russians have X, Y, and Z, and we need to get it. And so I say, we don't have any money. And they say, we'll lose the war. So I say, okay, we'll find the money. So there you go.
Well,
that
and
kind
of
says
course,
it all.
Of course, one of the longest lasting things that Ike gave us was his farewell speech. I think when he warned us about the, you know, beware the military industrial complex. I mean, if only we had, but of course we wouldn't. I loved there was something else in the book that fascinated me, and it's almost a throwaway. But you indicate that when Khrushchev gave a speech about complete disarmament, that the stock market reacted by plummeting. It lost over like 2 days, like several billion dollars in value, which at the time would be like a couple trillion dollars, I guess, today.
It would be a lot of money. I'm not sure the exact ratio, but a lot of money, yeah.
Wow.
Well, it was funny because Khrushchev kept saying, you know, your capitalists are trying to keep the Cold War going because they're making money on it. And the Americans, officials quite sincerely would say, oh, no, they would never do that. That's not, you know, you're crazy. You're just this crazy Marxist. That's not how it works. But then he made this ridiculous propaganda speech saying that all countries should get rid of all weapons, everything right, except for pistols worn by policemen. And even though there was absolutely no chance of that actually happening, the stock market plummeted because everyone was afraid that their defense stocks would go down.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a little bit right about his paranoia of the capitalists.
Well, I'm sure there's people who are going to look back at this whole Iraq and Afghanistan conflict and say it was kept going because a lot of people were making a lot of money on it, and it's not far off from, you know, what I warned about.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's the only reason we invaded Iraq or, you know, even the main reason, but it probably works out in there somewhere. Somebody did make a lot of money on it, and one of the companies, of course, was one that used to be headed by the vice president at the time. So that does look a little suspicious, doesn't it?
Shocking, just shocking. Well, let's come back here. How did you discover this story? You didn't remember it from a childhood thing. You ran across it, I think, while you were reading clips, I think, was it at People?
Yeah, I worked at People magazine in the early 80s, and I was a rewrite man, so you really couldn't rewrite anything until the people in the bureaus had written it and sent it in. So I worked really hard on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, but Thursdays and Fridays, there was basically nothing to do. So I would amuse myself by reading the clips kept in the wonderful Time Life library. And so I would, you know, call up the clips on somebody interesting like John Dillinger, I remember doing, and Emma Goldman. And one day I had read somewhere that Khrushchev had been denied access to Disneyland. And I thought to myself, that can't be true. So I called the library and said, can you send me the clips on Khrushchev's trip to the United States? And they said, sure. And then they called back about 15 minutes later and said, there are an awful lot of these clips. You sure you want them all? And I said, sure. And the messenger came up with a big cart filled with big manila envelopes stuffed with clips. I think there was at least one for each day of the trip, and there were 15 days. And so I emptied out the first one and just started looking at the headlines and the pictures, and I thought to myself, my God, this is so bizarre. I can't believe all this stuff happened. And I remember thinking to myself, it's really funny. All these funny things happened. But on the other hand, everybody was also worried about nuclear war. So there's the threat of that hanging over all this comedy. And I remember thinking to myself pretty early on, God, this is like a nonfiction Kurt Vonnegut novel. So I just kept collecting stuff about it, starting with Xeroxing those clippings and then going to people's memoirs of the trip. Everybody involved in the trip, including Khrushchev, wrote a memoir about it in some form or another. And there was just a rich variety of these one weird incident after another. I remember one of the first things I saw was that Khrushchev had gotten stuck in an elevator in the Waldorf Astoria.
Oh, that was a great story.
And they had to pry the door open, and they were between floors, so Henry Cabot Lodge, who was his tour guide, had to push Khrushchev's butt up so that he could climb out of the elevator onto the floor above. I said, I can't believe this actually happened. And then there were, incident after incident, at least as wacky as that one.
Well, and there's a postscript to that story, as I recall. Didn't the elevator operator later say that there was a little concern that if while they were doing that, the elevator suddenly started moving, it would have sliced him in half?
Yeah, right. Actually, the translator, who was Lodge's translator, said that. But yeah, I guess maybe they couldn't move with the door open. But if they did, oh my God, can you imagine? And since the Russians, the KGB guys who were guarding Khrushchev had already told the Americans that if anything happened to him, it would cause a nuclear attack. They should have been a little worried about that.
There were a lot of moments throughout the book where something could have gone very wrong, and the Russians could have been very unhappy with what happened. There was the story of the Iowa farmer who wanted Khrushchev to change his schedule and sneak out of the hotel at 6:30 in the morning and come visit by himself.
Yeah, that would have shocked them if he had done that. He said he wouldn't do that because they would think he had been kidnapped.
Yeah.
But can you imagine that? That would have been funny. Of course, the incident that happened because he didn't sneak out early was even funnier. The farmer who knew Khrushchev, who had sold Khrushchev 5,000 tons of seed corn, he wanted to show Khrushchev his farm, and he didn't want all these reporters hanging around. So since Khrushchev didn't sneak out and dodge, leave the reporters back in Des Moines, the reporters were there. 300 and some odd of them were registered for the trip. And they swarmed all over the farm, and the farmer, Roswell Garst, got really mad and ended up throwing silage at them while Khrushchev roared with laughter. He pulled a corn stalk out, Garst did, and attacked the photographers. I mean, it was another one of those wild incidents.
Now, which was the reporter that he kicked in the shin? It wasn't Kempton, was it?
No, Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's great. Now, the media, interestingly enough, the media comes off as poorly as anyone else covered in this book. Did you have any qualms about how poorly your brethren?
Oh, no. I mean, I thought, first of all, their behavior is probably bad. There's a couple of media riots described, one of them on the Garst farm, another in a supermarket in San Francisco. So they behaved badly. In a manner that's now familiar to all of us in the TV age. But on the other hand, the descriptions and the accounts that they wrote are so great. I mean, I quote extensively from the reporters of the day, And although I wasn't thinking about it at the time, I realized later when the book came out, now I've left the Post, I took a buyout, the newspaper industry is in terrible shape. Mm. And it kind of, you can read this as a tribute to what great stuff newspaper reporters could write on deadline when they had a really good story to go on. I mean, they just wrote some really funny and just great stuff.
Was it the reporters or the photographers and TV guys that were the problem from your vantage point?
Well, the photographers have to get closer. And
yeah.
The photographers were the ones that Garst threw the silage at, although he did kick a print guy, Harrison Salisbury.
Right.
And the photographers caused the riot in the supermarket because Khrushchev's guards made a circle around him to protect him from American shoppers, which probably wasn't necessary. But that caused the photographers who wanted to take pictures of him, you know, thumping a cantaloupe, they started climbing up. They had to seize the high ground so they could shoot down and get a picture of Khrushchev. So they started climbing on stuff and knocking it down, and they climbed up on the meat counter, and the butcher started trying to drag them off of it. So it got really crazy.
Did you get to see actual footage of that?
I did not see footage of that, and the funny thing is, I didn't see any still pictures of that one either. And at first I thought maybe the photographers who were there took pictures of their fellow photographers misbehaving but wouldn't show them. But I talked to an old-time photographer, and he said, no, in those days they were trained to take only a couple pictures. They had those old-fashioned cameras, and so they would only take one picture or two, and they would not waste film on, you know, some hijinks that wasn't going to get in the paper. So although it was widely covered by print reporters who watched it and described it, there are no pictures that I've ever seen of it.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I loved all the media coverage. And right at the beginning of the book, I should point out that the book actually starts not with Khrushchev in America, but with Nixon in Moscow. And there's a scene at the American exhibit in Moscow at the time, which I guess was kind of like a small World's Fair type of thing, where there's a lot of American stuff on display. And there was a model house, and all these reporters crowd in, right, to follow Khrushchev and Nixon. And of course, we had the famous kitchen debate. But they did the same thing there that they did in the supermarket.
Right, they swarmed in, and actually that was beautifully orchestrated by a PR guy named William Safire, who's now a columnist
people.
For the New York Times.
Right.
And he was the PR guy for that house. And he describes in his memoirs watching Khrushchev and Nixon and this huge mob of reporters heading towards his house. So he actually got a car out and dragged down with a chain, dragged a fence down, and then started saying, step right this way to a typical American house. And Khrushchev and Nixon stepped into the house, and all the reporters followed them. And he signaled to the people running the other door to let the Russian fairgoers in. So Khrushchev and Nixon were basically trapped in the kitchen of this house. They couldn't have gotten out if they wanted to. And so they had their famous kitchen debate.
Safire. Who would have guessed?
Who would have known?
Did... Now, this whole thing started with you reading the Time Life Morgue stories on all this. As you got into it and decided to make a book of it, well, first of all, how did it go from curiosity to obsession to book? When did you decide there was enough there to write a book about?
Well, once I started, once I was reading those clips, I thought to myself, this could be a book, and I started Xeroxing, you know, making. Furtive forays to the Xerox machine and Xeroxing these clips, which obviously had nothing to do with the work I was supposed to be performing for People magazine.
Yeah, and by the way, I have Time Life online, too. They'd like a nickel for every copy that you made. Money's a little tight these days.
Yeah, tell them the check's in the mail.
All right, sorry, go ahead.
So then I made these clippings, and then and I started reading the memoirs of the people who were involved in that, and I would Xerox them. And then in 1986, a couple years later, I went to the Washington Post. And so they made me work hard all, you know, Monday through Friday, so I didn't have a lot of time on my hands. But I casually, whenever I came across something, I would look up if they had anything about the Khrushchev trip, because I was still interested. So I kept saving stuff. And then a few years ago, the Post had its first buyout, and I thought to myself, gee, the newspaper business isn't doing too good. I better figure out something else to do. And then I realized, well, you know, the 50th anniversary of Khrushchev's trip is coming up. If I'm ever going to write this book, I guess I ought to do it for that. So I did.
Got it. All right. And so was all of the research done based on newspaper and magazine morgues, or did you get to actually interview some of the people who were involved?
Oh yeah, I did. I did newspaper and magazine clips, then the memoirs, and then I interviewed about six or eight people who I could find who had been on the trip, mostly newspaper reporters, but also Henry Cabot Lodge's translator, who was always by Lodge's side. So when Khrushchev and Lodge would drive from one place to another, obviously none of the newspaper reporters knew what they were saying, but this guy was there, so he knew. And he and Lodge sent back memos every night to the State Department saying what happened that day. And those I found at the National Archives, along with a lot of other documents about the trip, the preparations for the trip, the memos of people who were on the trip. And also I found box after box of letters of people who, when they heard Khrushchev was coming to the United States, wanted him to come to their house or their school or their farm or their factory or their department store. So I have a chapter in there that's just full of these goofy invitations to Khrushchev. I got all that from the National Archives.
Well, and as goofy as they were, maybe the goofiest one they actually accepted. Well, Nina Khrushchev accepted was the American Dry Cleaning Institute?
Yes, and I interviewed the guy who was at that time still the PR man for the Dry Cleaning Association.
John
yeah,
J.
When Khrushchev was at Camp David with Ike, they didn't bring their wives. So this guy, who was very clever, realized that Mrs. Khrushchev was left in Washington with nothing to do, so he invited her to tour this dry cleaning plant. And since he really must have been really bored, she actually accepted. And they had this preposterous publicity stunt for dry cleaning, starring the wife of the dictator of the world's largest country, who wandered through this goofy thing looking at dry cleaning techniques. And it was on the front page of the New York Times. It was a great coup by this PR man named John Daly, who's still around. He still lives in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
The story just kept getting weirder.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you interview Sergei Khrushchev?
Oh, yeah. I've interviewed Sergei a bunch of times. And
Sergei.
Actually, recently he interviewed me for a show on C-SPAN. It'll be shown at the end of the month, where it's called Afterwards, and they get a guy who has written a nonfiction book and someone who knows about the topic, and the expert interviews the author. So Sergei interviewed me. So, yeah, I interviewed him a bunch of times, and he showed me his home movies from the trip.
Yeah.
Which he made. When he was on the trip, he was 25 years old. Now he's 75, I guess. It's 50 years later. And he's a professor at Brown University. He's an American citizen. He's a really nice guy. And, he remembered a lot about the trip, and he invited me to watch these home movies. So this was a few years ago. I flew up to Providence, Rhode Island, and it was a few days after Christmas, and my wife packed a plate of Christmas cookies, and Sergei picked me up at the airport with a couple salami and cheese sandwiches, and we went to his office and ate the cookies and the sandwiches and watched his home movies of the trip. it was really kind of cool.
Now Sergei sounds like a fascinating personality in his own regard. Nothing like his daddy, of course.
Well, he's gone into another line of work. He looks a lot like his father, actually.
Well, he does. I wondered about that.
Okay. Yeah, and he has spent a large portion of his adult life writing about his father. He's written several books about his father. He just completed, he told me, a 600,000-word book on his father's domestic reforms. Wow.
Oh, my God.
And I thought he might be a little upset because, you know, he spent his whole adult life sort of polishing the image of his father.
Yeah.
And I wrote this book in which his father is a comic character, and I thought, you know, he may not like this. So I wondered what would happen when he interviewed me for this TV show, but he liked it. I mean, he thought his father was funny, too. And it turned out he really liked the book, so I was pleasantly surprised about that.
Is the helicopter coming to take you to Camp David?
I think
right
it
now?
Is. Yeah, it's one of those black helicopters. And they're dropping down. Wait, they're dropping down one of Obama's death panels. They're coming to see if I have to put Granny, into the hospice. No,
you know,
I don't know what it is. I live on the path between Washington and Camp David, so sometimes we get that helicopter traffic. But it's only Thursday, so probably not.
Well, that's funny. And here I suggested they were coming to get you for Camp David, and I had no idea where you lived. That's amazing. I try, you know, to find some music or maybe a sound effect or maybe a clip to go with some interviews. I couldn't really think of anything to go with this, and you provided your own. That was wonderful.
There you go. Well, you could also play a Russian Bandstand, which was
right,
a novelty record that some people made. The gist, right when he was coming here, the gist of which was, what would it be like if Nikita Khrushchev ran a Russian version of American Bandstand? And it's pretty funny, actually. And if you go on YouTube, somebody has turned that into a little movie, you know, a little like music video, with Khrushchev is made out of Legos. It's really quite bizarre.
I will look for that. Now, I asked you before about the media. They don't come off very well in the book. But more importantly, Richard Nixon doesn't come off any better in this book from an era when he should have been coming off a little better, but he doesn't. There's really nothing good that you can take away about Richard Nixon from this book, is there?
Well, I thought that, you know, I'm not his biggest fan, but I thought he came off better, you know, than he would if I was, say, writing a biography of him. Because
well,
here it is, the poor guy is vice president of the United States, and he's going to run for president the next year. And he goes to Moscow to be the official American host of this American exhibition. So he has to sort of show, it's going to be all this media, and he has to show that he can stand up to Khrushchev, you know, show how tough he is to the voters back home. And then the day before he goes, Ike, or actually the same day, before he gets on the plane to fly over there, Ike summons him to the White House and says, "Oh, by the way, Dick, I haven't told you this, but I've invited Khrushchev to the United States, and he has accepted. And so basically, you know, be nice to him over there, because he's coming over here." And so poor Nixon was faced between the necessity of looking tough around Khrushchev and the necessity of, you know, doing what Eisenhower told him to do and being nice to Khrushchev. So the poor guy was in a pickle. And he handled it pretty well, given the circumstances. The only really bad scene in the book about him is when he was allowed to make a speech on Russian TV. Mm. And he came back, and I guess he was in a bad mood, and he started drinking martinis. He had quite a few martinis and got bombed.
Right.
And one of the embassy officials who was there that night reported that he was really nasty. He kept saying, "How did you like my speech? How do you like the part where I said this?" And the sycophantic people working there would say, "Oh, yeah, that was really good." And that wasn't good enough for him. So he kept getting nastier and nastier. So he didn't come off too well in that particular incident.
No.
But other than that, I was kind of impressed how he managed to duke it out with Khrushchev, who was a really tough guy to handle.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially because they didn't know anything about him. I mean, that was I wanted to ask you. Oh, now you've got birds in the background. My goodness.
Oh, yeah, we've got it all here in Rockville, Maryland.
They knew so little about Khrushchev at that point. One of the things that I didn't get was, did you have any sense from what you read and the research you did that Ike's staff or Nixon talked to any of our allies in Europe who may have had more contact with Khrushchev, or did none of that exist at the time? Because I think, okay, I get now, like the last 8 years, the Bush people, they just didn't talk to people they didn't like, and they weren't interested in our allies' opinions on anything. It just didn't exist. But you know, previous administrations, it seems like they'd do the legwork and they'd go and talk to people and find out. Didn't they get any information from, you know, the French or the Italians or?
Oh yeah, I think they did. And Nixon did a lot of legwork, talking to people who had met Khrushchev. And since Khrushchev loved meeting people, he'd met all kinds of people. The Hearst columnist Bob Considine, Nixon summoned him to lunch because he'd interviewed Khrushchev. And Considine told him, you know, Khrushchev tries to win all his arguments by coming up with these folksy Russian proverbs, so you should have a bunch of American proverbs to come back with. So Nixon,
right,
you know, jotted this down on the back of an envelope and then proceeded to memorize all these American proverbs so he could use them when he got to Moscow. But they knew a lot about Khrushchev because Khrushchev was pretty open about meeting people. And in fact, the American ambassador at the time, Tommy Thompson, mm-hmm, was pretty good pals with Khrushchev. And the two of them had a really good relationship, actually, at that time. Later on, it got a little worse after U2. But at the time, they really had a pretty good relationship. And so I'm sure people in the State Department and Eisenhower were pretty well informed as to what Khrushchev was like. But it's a closed system, and he had been one of Stalin's henchmen, and they were kind of afraid of him. They didn't know whether he'd, you know, go to the good side or the bad side. And as I say, he could be very charming and warm, and on the other hand, he would throw these temper tantrums and threaten to bury us and stuff. So he was hard to get a handle on.
You have a great description of him, how the I think Lodge sent back a cable, right, where he described how the temper tantrum would start, that the back of his neck, and of course Khrushchev was bald as an egg, the back of his neck would start getting red, and then the red would rise over the top of his head, I think.
Right, and then rise and then fall over his face.
Yeah.
It scared people. And as it turned out, at least some of the temper tantrums were fake. So
yeah,
he proved to be a great actor. But his face would get red, and he'd start shaking his fist and talking about how we're churning out missiles like sausages. And he scared the hell out of people.
did you ever wish in writing this that you had been one of the press?
Oh, yeah, all the time. It was a great story to cover. In fact, I did a reading in a bookstore here, and Don Oberdorfer, a former Post reporter who retired years and years ago, he showed up and said it was the most fun he'd ever had in newspapers, that he had been a cub reporter covering this trip, and it was the most fun he'd ever had, and he had a career of, I don't know, 40 years or something.
Yeah, it's amazing. That would have been something to be on. Well, so it's a wonderful book. What are you doing next? Do you have something else you've started on?
Haven't. I the publisher wants me to do another book, and I want to do another book, and we just have to figure out a topic that they think people will want to buy.
Hmm.
The book business is not in the greatest shape these days, and they seem less likely these days to do quirky topics. I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have gotten a contract to do this one if it came along now, because things are a little tighter in the book business. So I certainly hope to do something. I have got some ideas, and we'll see what we can work out.
Anybody talking about a movie of this?
Somebody bought an option to make a movie. It would be a very fun movie. I think if you're an actor who's bald, short, bald, and fat, this would be just perfect for you. Danny DeVito would be great, I think.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah.
But anybody else who's a, you know, short, fat, bald scenery chewer, because Khrushchev could just love to be the center of attention and would do anything to be the center of attention. So it's a great role for an actor, and there's plenty of comedy in it. So some people in Hollywood saw that and have optioned it. Whether a movie will actually result, I certainly hope so, but we will see.
That's great. I have no problem picturing that. I think that'd be hysterical. Well, look, folks, you can find Peter Carlson's book, K Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's Most Unlikely Tourist, at great bookstores everywhere or online at MrMedia.com or Amazon.com. And Peter, it was great fun reading the book and delightful to talk to you. I appreciate you taking time out to join us on the show today.
Well, nice for inviting me. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Good luck to you with the book and the movie.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Take it easy.
Take care. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with your favorite journalists and authors, surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with A.J. Jacobs of Esquire, John Darton of the New York Times, 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner for features, Lane DeGregory, Washington Post reporter Philip Sheenan, and Writer's Digest publisher Jane Friedman, among many others. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant, Digital Journal, Vox, Podcast Pickle, MediaFly, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thank you so much for joining us today. Always appreciate it when you give up a little piece of your day and spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.